Welcome to the El Arpa podcast, the home for cultural chit-chat in and outside Madrid. People will talk. Welcome back to the latest episode of the El Arpa podcast. Thank you for listening to our last one, our interview with Mercedes. That was a very popular one. But back with me today, of course, is Mary, fresh from the south of Spain and Budapest, Hungary. Any hungry for a new year of podcasts?
Hello, anyway.
Hello, excellent. So back to our usual high quality banter. I myself was in Berlin for a few days, and that was the majority of my holiday. But the summer is drawing to a close, and we rumble on with big plans for this year. I guess we can finally say it, no? We can't give away too much information, but we are writing a book. A proper book with a proper publishing house that will be released in proper bookshops.
Mm-hmm.
In December.
Yeah.
Are you excited?
I'm very excited.
Yeah. We won't say what it's about.
No, not really.
Yeah.
It's a surprise.
It's a surprise. I'm not sure we're allowed to.
But it's a very current topic, I would say.
As you say in Spain, it's a trending topic.
Yeah.
So that's what that is. And it's very exciting. And once we have this published, we're going to take it to Steven Spielberg. Maybe get a movie deal out of it. As well. So how have you found the writing experience so far? Because I know you've written papers and blog articles and stories and poems and all these wonderful things. But you've never written a book before, unless you've started a novel when you were 7 and you abandoned it.
Well, I kind of did a couple of times, yes. I got to 30 pages
when
I was like 12.
Yeah, that's 1/4 novella, yeah?
Yeah. No, I did start a couple of times, I found it nice, very different from what I've done before, because obviously writing for academia is just very
dry.
Well, not dry, but it's just a different style, because you're kind of like, you have to make things understandable, but you're writing mostly for other academics, so well, you have to make an effort to structure it, but it's a different kind of effort to a book for the general public, where you're trying to get them to understand not just what you're talking about, but the whole context, and you cannot assume any knowledge. And even when you're writing for academia, they tell you not to assume any knowledge either, but it's not quite the same, practically. And also there's the entertaining factor, because you're never aiming to... It's probably not a good thing to say, but you're never aiming to entertain when you're writing something in academia. It's more like to inform.
Yeah.
And, well, I think with the book, we're aiming to be informative, but also entertaining.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that, because our editor was, I think, worried that our tone would be too academic, because we both come from academia. You more than me. And speaking of academia, it's a website, isn't it?
Academia.eu.
Yeah, where people, you can check if some people have read your thesis and things like that, and
yes.
Cited it. Well, now I'm following you on that.
I know.
I'm not sure how that happened, but it happens. Yeah, we are writing a popular history that goes from, well, ancient times to
modern times.
So it's all the history. Everything that's ever happened.
Yeah.
It's in this book. We have worked in some sex into the book as well, mostly my chapters. But
what? When was that?
I
mean, like, what's up?
So that's my plane clicking in the background, if you hear that as well.
Like, what chapters? No, you cannot talk about anything. This is the thing, like, just don't say.
The French one and the Russian one.
Well, okay, say no more.
And Zac Efron makes an appearance.
Whatever.
My name won't be on that particular chapter, but I will be calling him a heartthrob. In the context of this historical work.
Yeah, that was scary enough. To read.
To read, and scary to write as well. But it's interesting what you say, because also we were having a discussion last week about citations. So it's not an academic book, but how do we handle the citations and things like that? So apart from finding the topics and researching it and reading it, or writing it, I should say, kind of like working out the mechanics. I think the tone for us was very easy to find because we have experience with the blog and we know how to kind of tell something that's factual and historical, but in a rip-roaring way. But like the other mechanics of it would be in terms of how to insert the citations, which is a bit more natural in an academic text. But we're finding the way. I think it's not too taxing, and there's a lot of work and it's enjoyable, but I think we have a decent enough handle on it. But more news, I guess, closer to December when it's all handed in. But excitement.
Yes, yeah. And then we know what to get everybody for Christmas.
Signed copies of somebody else's book.
No.
So that's the big news on holiday. Signed a book deal. It's been a crazy summer. And so you were negotiating this on our behalf while you were away as well. So you were jet setting and closing deals. Very exotic. Before we go to part two, I guess we can briefly mention Brexit. I was hoping to do a longer episode on this because I wanted to do more research into it, even though we
both... Because you don't really care about it.
Well, obviously I've been following it a lot with podcasts and with the newspapers as well. I don't know. I've been talking a lot so far. I know. I'm giving you the entry point of Brexit to pipe up. But how do you think it's all progressing?
Well, really badly. it's just getting crazy, isn't it? I mean, there are some people that think it's getting better, but I think most of the public doesn't really think it's getting any better. But, well, it'd be interesting to see what comes out of the G7 meeting this week.
Yeah.
I think a very important point is what happens with Parliament, because at the moment there's the issue of whether he's gonna force it to close for a few weeks, and that would be quite a, I don't know, dramatic thing without any precedent that would cause, I think, quite a lot of problems. It's already causing a lot of debate about whether it's doable or not, or justifiable, and we'll all be resolved in October.
What do you think about the Lib Dems and Corbyn? The controversy there about whether the Lib Dems should support Corbyn as some kind of alternative flagpole or leader. Because one thread of this story is that Corbyn, if Labour had a stronger leader, then probably we wouldn't be quite in this mess, or in a mess like this. It would be a lot better. But there's been no opposition to the Brexiteers and the Conservative Party. The Lib Dems have kind of pushed back. The people like Nigel Farage and his party, and now they're at a crossroads whether to kind of, I don't know, support Labour more and support Jeremy Corbyn as their divisive leader. What are your thoughts on that aspect of the Brexit process as well?
Well, I think it's all gonna depend on what the next move is, because Corbyn said as soon as Boris Johnson was elected, then he would call a vote of no confidence, which he didn't.
Yeah.
But then he could see that many Conservatives were defecting anyway, and there's a whole lot of them that have left over the summer.
Yeah.
And so he doesn't have like the huge majority that he had before in terms of support in his own party.
Yeah, but the thing is, the people who have left, like some of them set up a party themselves, which failed spectacularly. Also, the problem with Corbyn is that so much has happened, everything's happening, so many things seem to happen every day, but if you roll back maybe a month or two, the Labour manifesto for Brexit after Boris Johnson was elected was also very wishy-washy as well. So at kind of critical junctures, I think there was a space for Corbyn to to be more proactive and to pull in the direction that the majority of the people in his party want him to pull in. But just like it seems inevitable that Boris Johnson won't avoid a no-deal Brexit, it seems inevitable that Jeremy Corbyn won't actually lead his party decisively. But before we go to part two, I will mention that if you want to see it from an Irish perspective, there are some resources we can put in the description of the podcast. One was a fantastic, and this is not hyperbolic, this is probably one of the best articles I've ever read in the Irish Times. My brother sent it to me. Basically about how we're getting our news about Brexit from the British, and of course the Tory press are going to town on our Prime Minister, who's done a fantastic job in defending the interests of our country, well, my country, Ireland. And they're trying to pin the blame for the dead, what's it, punto muerte, what's that, deadlock in English, over the stopgap in Northern Ireland. They're trying to pin the blame on the Irish government and the Irish Prime Minister. But the article was saying that we should get our news from other sources, from German media, from French media. Now that's interesting, because that's also a counterpoint that the European media on the continent aren't necessarily talking about Brexit as much, because as far as they're concerned, the European Union position is quite clear. And also he's kind of making the claim that like Ireland hopefully can seize this opportunity to plug in a deeper sense to European intellectual life, and that we are sometimes colonized in the mind and caught in this kind of lazy sphere of British culture and British information, and particularly around Brexit, that information is misinformation, it could be an opportunity for Ireland to break out of that and plug more so into Europe, and I'll be very excited about that prospect. In terms of podcasts, Dave McWilliams is a economic expert. He has his own podcast called the David McWilliams Podcast, and he talks about economic issues every week. He's done one on Brexit recently, which was fascinating as well, because he's talking about how like a lot of the things, I can't remember, is the guy who was in Britain who's the head of their CBI, I think it is called, and he believed that Irish trade with Britain was dependent, like we exported 90% of our 90% of our exports went to Britain, when in actual fact it's only 11%. And in fact, the British are more dependent on exporting to us than we are on them. And since the 90s, we've diversified our economy really deeply. So we have a lot of irons in the fire. And he's also making the point culturally that, you know, while a lot of countries are maybe stepping to the right, you look at Britain, America, Hungary, but we have a gay immigrant as our prime minister, and we've voted on two abortions recently. So we are kind of maybe stepping to the left. So again, there's a lot of misinformation he talks about in that podcast, but how the Tories and the Conservatives, when they're thinking of Ireland and speaking about Ireland and even negotiating with Ireland, they have a conception of a country back in the 50s and the 60s and 70s, and they don't really realize that how modern an economy the Irish economy is, and how rich the country is as well. It's one of the better performing economies in the world at the moment. And also, going to another podcast, which we can also link in the description, Eamon Dunphy. Now, he is an interesting broadcaster. He describes himself as a Republican in the French sense, not in the Irish sense. Well, I would describe myself a Republican in the Irish sense. But he also talks about these kind of the kind of fallout from Brexit and what it means economically for Ireland. He's done a few episodes in this, but again, the same story is like that what I find fascinating is that there's still people in Britain who support Brexit who believe that they can do a trade deal in a fortnight rather than a number of years. So it's going to be a serious disadvantage for them as well. Going back to David McWilliams, he spoke about Irish independence, how for the first 70 years the economy was pretty much stagnant. So his advice when he finished his podcast was, well, for Brexit Britain, the first 70 years are tough, but if you can get past that, it's all gravy. So yeah, so that's a lot of information there. We put that into the description. So what we can do is maybe go to part two, talk about Berlin, maybe some German literature, some other odds and ends, and we'll join you momentarily after the musical interlude. Welcome to part two of the show. So you were given a beautiful present recently of a music box.
I was.
How did that come into your possession?
I don't know. It just...
It was from me. So, it plays... what's the name of this tune?
It's a waltz.
It's a waltz, yeah. And the picture of Vincent van Gogh. Starry, starry night in the outside as well.
Yep.
Have you played it?
Yes, I have.
Yeah, it's actually great because when you're like angry at me, I play it to keep you calm and to bring you back to your happy place. And it's proven to be very successful in that regard.
That's only happened like...
Twice.
In the same space of an hour.
That's true, in quick succession. So we, at the top of this part two, and we can talk about Berlin, German literature as well. Or is there any, so we can talk about that first, or we can go to a second. Is there anything that you want to get off your chest, that you want to talk about, Mary?
No, I really want to listen to all your explanation about the literature.
Okay, very nice. Yeah, okay, so in part one, actually, I mentioned David McWilliams' podcast, and he... has this device where he calls somebody and then the person who he calls like asks him questions, but it seems like the questions are like rehearsed, that they're like written down or something like that. It's interesting. I wonder if that's actually the case. That's beside the point anyway. So I'll explain. I've been to Berlin for, this is our first podcast for a while. We're getting back into it. No, I went to Berlin for 6 days, and you've been there before as well. Very briefly, you were there for an Egyptology convention.
I was there for a vernacular architecture conference.
A what conference?
Vernacular architecture. So it wasn't just Egypt. It was like a modern thing. And, you know, it wasn't just archaeology. And it was for all over the world.
It's interesting you use the word vernacular, because we will be taking a linguistic turn in this part as well. So you saw the Reichstag.
Briefly. That's the only thing I saw, because the rest of the time I spent 3 days in a lecture theater.
Yeah.
Listening to talks, so I didn't get a chance to see anything of the city.
Watching arguments as well.
Yeah, well, as it usually happens in these type of conferences, but yeah, I didn't get a chance, so it's a shame, because I could see... There were so many interesting things I wanted to see, and I didn't get a chance. So.
To be fair though, near the Reichstag is the Bundestag. And then you have also the Brandenburg Gate.
So. Yeah, I mean, I went there because I thought, well, just try to see as many things as I can in 15 minutes.
So you've seen two things?
All right, yeah, technically.
Okay, get your facts straight. And you're impressed, no?
Yeah, of course.
Well, I saw the DDR Museum.
Yeah, you saw many more things than you're going to tell me now.
Yeah, which is amazing. They had a recreation of... East German school, an East German house. You go to all the rooms of the house, the bedrooms, the bathroom, and you could, very interactive, very nice museum. You can open up the drawers and there's like little information cards. Go into the sitting room, the salon, you can watch TV. You can just press different buttons in the remote and it'll show you what was on TV in West Germany and East Germany on a particular date. I can't remember what date they chose, but it was just at, you know, one specific day. Now, the DDR, of course, was the East German part of Berlin. So they're just showing the West German channel as well for two reasons. To show you the contrast between the contents, because as you can imagine, the West German one was a bit more, well, it was freer, while the East German one was a bit more state propaganda and things like that. But in the book that I'm going to talk about, he does talk about how, like, it's always funny, the difference between the news reports from the East and the West. It's kind of a satirical book, ironic book, so he has a lot of fun with that. And the DDR Museum is, it's a lot of fun. Went to Checkpoint Charlie to see that. No, I didn't get a t-shirt there, actually. That was on the last day. But it is showing Checkpoint Charlie, yeah.
Well, so exactly. There. So, like, you know, went there, got a t-shirt.
And then we went to the Berlin Story Museum. There's two museums there, and the Berlin Story one is absolutely massive. You would spend 4 hours there, basically. It kind of shows how Nazism took hold, so it shows like a lot of like Adolf Hitler when he was younger, his paintings and things like that. And then it goes through all of World War II, and then it goes, like, it finishes in the bunker, and this tells the story of how Magda Goebbels killed her children, how she was a recreation of his sofa, pictures of Russians and soldiers in the bunker, Russian soldiers in the bunker, American soldiers in the bunker. There's an Irish family behind me, actually, and the kids were like, who was Hitler? And the father is trying to explain to him. So the museum is intense.
Short answer.
It's a really good museum, though. It's definitely, like, very interesting. And what I like about it is the guy who's behind it is very political, which, is, as you can imagine, you know, makes sense. But, like, I've seen, you know, museums in Ireland being painfully neutral. And as we've discussed before, in history, there's no true objectivity. So subjectivity here, I think, is very warranted. It's inspirational in a sense. Sometimes you kind of think he's taking too harsh a tone. But there's one point where he's like, "This is, we have not received any money from the state. Zero." Like, literally what he says. And I'm not sure if it's a rebuke to the government or if he's just saying that this is like, look how wonderful this is. It's been...
For the museum.
Yeah, for the museum. It's been supported by... by whatever. And then at the end, it's quite interesting because he shows like that there's a lot of conspiracies that Hitler didn't kill himself and he went off to Argentina and things like that. And, yeah. And he really lambasts the History Channel for kind of like having a documentary where they interview experts, in inverted commas, one of whom was actually Spanish. And they go to a convent, I think, yeah, in Argentina, and there's a nun there who's like, oh, it was definitely Hitler. I couldn't go into his room, but it was him. And he's like saying like it's broadcast in all these different countries, and he really takes them to task for being very irresponsible in terms of just like trying to create like this entertainment, which is what the History Channel has become in a lot of ways as well. So I think that does have a lot of merit. So I think, you know, it's just, it was nice to see a museum that I'm guessing having the space to do it because it's all privately financed, really just like say, well, this is my stance on certain things, and this is what I really believe, and I'm not going to sugarcoat it. And yeah, so it's quite different from the normal museum experience, but it was quite good. Went on a boat, Berlin Cathedral, definitely check that out. That is absolutely gorgeous. I'll buy you a postcard with the cathedral on it. And bike ride, the Berlin Wall, of course, as well. A lot of graffiti there. So yeah, all in all, 200 museums apparently in the city.
Wow.
It's four times the size of Paris, but the population density is a lot different. I think in Paris, if I remember correctly, it's like per square kilometer, you have like 20,000 people. In Berlin, per square kilometer, on average, you have 4,000 people. So that's why you feel like you have like whole parks and boulevards to yourself, which is which was my experience of Berlin, because I did find like that like it just seemed empty in certain points, you know. So, and then like we went down Karl Marx Alley, which is this huge Soviet era boulevard, and the architecture there was really just these Soviet blocks, and it's quite interesting as well because like in one sense the wide boulevard is really impressive, but there's been psychological reports about how like if you walk past a building for maybe 5 minutes and there's no interruption in the style of the building or even trees, things like that, if it's just very uniform, it does have a very real effect on your well-being and your mental health and things like that. So I can imagine like that living there under the great communism wasn't as beautiful a boulevard as it looks in modern day Berlin. So any questions about Berlin?
This is like, this should be part of a series of like European cities in 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Everything you need to know.
Next week, Lisbon.
No, that was really interesting. Thank you for telling us about it, but I think some of the aspects that you've talked about you kind of like encounter on those 20 million books that you brought back from Berlin.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, because we've spoken before. We have an episode called What Joseph Roth Saw.
Yeah.
And I bought 5 books back, I think. Two were just photographic books. One was a novel, which was subsequently made into a movie with Brendan Gleeson and Daniel Brühl, about this couple who, also Emma Thompson, I think, they leave postcards announcing Hitler all over Berlin because their son was killed on the front. And then like Daniel Brühl in the movie version plays the Nazi detective who is trying to track him down. It's this kind of like allegory, not really allegory, but it really explores the kind of tense nature of what I was like living in that type of situation, the kind of suspicion, just trying to get by, and then people ratting each other out and things like that. There's other two other books. One was called Berlin's Stories. Well, I'm going to just walk over here for a second, so my voice gets more faint. That's why. Berlin Stories. I should have trusted myself. That's exactly what it's called. By Robert Wells. I've just started that. So he's a Swiss guy who moved to Berlin, and he wrote three novels while he was there, and didn't have writer's block, and then it took him a while to write again. The stories are interesting. The first chapter is like basically like he's walking around Berlin in the early, well, the early hours in the morning, basically like 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock in the morning, and it kind of parallels with Joseph Roth's book, because there's a chapter there where he talks about like walking around Berlin in the early morning when people are coming back from their parties and things like that, and he kind of like glamorizes it and romanticizes it. And it's relatable because you know like that you've had that experience as well when you're going to work in the morning and people are finishing their party from the night before. And he mentions in the book how annoying they are. And he's right. I mean, those people are very annoying. So things like that, you know. And also, I haven't gotten very far into it, but like he was involved with the theater. So there'll be more stories about that, which of course Berlin is also very famous for those kind of things as well. He talks about being on a like electric tram, how everybody's like staring forward and things like that, which again has kind of modern parallels. He talks about like the food you can eat, going for a walk in the park, like these kind of observations that like today, I don't think it did it very well fully, but back when they were first published, like a lot of famous writers apparently were in hysterics reading his stories because they're very ironic and satirical of the kind of norms of that time. But because our cultural norms have shifted, it's sometimes hard to find the humor in that. But as I said, I've only read the first chapter, there's four chapters, so it could get better. But the book that really impressed me was The Wall Jumper, which I can give to you after this podcast as well, by a man called Peter Schneider. It's written in the 80s, and my copy even has an introduction by Ian McEwan, if that means anything to you. So I've been telling you about this book. I've been throwing the books all over here. It's okay.
Throwing books all over.
I'm going to finish that one. I can throw it away or throw it around. So yeah, I've been telling this to you off microphone. So, I mean, have I done a good job of piquing your interest in this story? And if so, pourquoi?
Well, it did sound very interesting, but it also sounded like quite intense. And I'm not sure if...
Really?
Yes. So is it or is it not?
Intense in what sense?
Yeah, like, I don't know, you were describing the story and it's a couple and it kind of like talks about when they're together and when they're not together. One is from West Germany, another one is from East Germany.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like a culture clash and told through a bit of a dramatic story.
Well, to be honest with you, there's like this anonymous narrator. We don't know who he is, but he's the protagonist of the story. You have his friend Robert, who is a writer who's fled from East Germany to live in West Germany. He's another friend. Let me check the back of the book.
Is this book like famous at all in Germany?
For example, Werner Herzog, the great director, has said it's the best depiction of the Berlin Wall. The Guardian also echoed that as well. So I think it's famous as... I mean, it's a Penguin classic.
In its general. Oh, well, if it's a Penguin classic, then what can we say?
So, exactly. But, and he's a friend called Pomerer, who lives in the East, but he's constantly trying to outwit the state. So he kind of, like, is friends with these two guys, and there's Lena, his girlfriend. Now, he spends more time talking to Robert, and then, in second place, Pomerer. And then Lena doesn't actually prop up in the story as much as maybe I suggested in telling you my kind of, like, my summary of it. And then there's like other characters that appear in the stories that Robert and Palmer tell him, or that he hears from other people as well. So you have like the basic structure of each chapter is like he talks to one of these people, learns a story, and then like he comments on the differences between East and West. And of course every person here has a function in the chapter, in the story, because like Robert, as I said, he's a writer from the East. Now through him we can see how his frustration at being in the West, because like his perception is like that everybody in the West wants him to prove that the Western way of life is superior. So it's not just enough for him to be there, he has to actually actively say the East is terrible and the West is the best, you know. But also as well, rhyming intended. But also, like, the like one thing that's really present in all the novel is like he's comparing East and West. The narrator is, in terms of like, where is the identity, where is the self begin and where does the state end? Because there are so many differences between him and the people from the East. Because in reality, all his friends, well, his two of his friends in the story and his ex-girlfriend are from the East, and they're markedly different from him. And to try and explore that, if he had been born in the East, would he have been similar to them? And he concludes that probably yes. And then how, you know, unconsciously and intuitively, like, both him and the people from the East are carrying their states with them. And that kind of manifests itself in different ways. So, like, in one sense, it's very open. There's one scene where him and Robert are watching an ice hockey match between the USSR and America. And because the narrator's from America, he's kind of going for the Americans. But because the other guy's from the East, he wants the USSR to win. There's another scene where it's like there's a riot and people try to break the glass of a window, of a shop window. And he actually describes this really in a very funny way, because he talks about the kind of youth. It was like maybe 20, having the wrist of a girl, had like trying very hard to break the window, but not doing a very good job of it. And him, for the Westerner, for the West Berliner, for the narrator, this is like just it's just social agitation. It's nothing really, to look deeply into. But for the guy from the East, he's perceiving it as something that's been orchestrated by the state, and basically like that the people, it was like a plan to trap people. You know, so the police would come in, pretending to be social agitators and see who would join them, then later they could arrest them, for example. So his view of the state and his kind of suspicion is kind of more apparent in this kind of scene, you know. And I mentioned linguistically as well, so I'll go into his relationship with his ex-girlfriend, because that's how linguistically the kind of book really takes off. But he talks about like how his experience of being a West Berliner, his first experience of the Allied soldiers was taking chewing gum from American soldiers and learning to say in English, the first words in English, "Do you have any chewing gum?" While he's speculating that if he'd born in the East, his first words would have been, "Do you have a cigarette?" He mentions the Russian soldiers were rapists, but the American soldiers were having love affairs. This kind of like different kind of cultural experiences. He also kind of speculates as well, like he was, well, in the character in the book, he's 10 years older than the DDR. And the West German government as well. So he says, like, this state does not represent me. I'm older than the state. But going back to the linguistic kind of motif, it's like, I can say I'm German because I speak German. And the language that unites us trumps the state, because the state of a greater Germany does not exist. And the West German state does not really reflect me fully. And the East German state doesn't reflect me fully either. So in lieu of that, instead of that, the language kind of takes its place as well. So it's kind of this kind of fascinating look at like boundaries and barriers and walls and what they kind of do, how they become internalized, even become banal, and how they even become like everyday and commonplace. And just because it's there, maybe it's an object of revolts or kind of like fighting the system, but in a very specific individualistic way, that how it manifests itself is kind of devoid of any maybe greater meaning, perhaps ironically as well. I mentioned his ex-girlfriend, to stick with the linguistic kind of idea, as I've told you before off the microphone, she takes everything that he says at face value, because if you say it once, it's an eternal truth. She starts becoming suspicious of him. She reads like the biography of people in their faces or by what they say, almost like the state of the East is, you know, she carries that kind of mentality with her, like she's analyzing people, friend or foe. He mentions that she doesn't like irony or subjunctive being a grammatical tense, which indicates possibility or something that may or may not happen, while in East Germany, because you've all these simplistic communistic slogans, they deal more in absolutes and clarity and things that are definitely going to happen, or this state is definitely the best state in the world. While because he's a Westerner, things are a bit, there's more room for doubt or subjectivity or nuance in language, because there's no official language, there's no state language. It's only the German language, but it differs across the wall because of the differences between the mentalities as well. So there's more I can say about the actual stories themselves if you want, but I don't know if you have any comments or question or thing like that.
Well, I was just wondering while you were explaining, like, whether you think he kind of like reinforces the stereotypes between, or the differences between West Germany and East Germany, you know, like those sort of statements like the Russians are rapists and the Americans are having love affairs and, you know, do you think it's a bit kind of like...
No, I mean, I that's a good question. I mean, no, in terms of the rape, because, I mean, it's undeniable that Russian soldiers raped on a massive scale in Berlin. So, I mean, I think fundamentally, the Americans rolled into town like movie stars, I think. And then the Russians, like, everybody's trying to escape the Russians because their reputation preceded them. So I think in terms of that, then I think he's probably right on the money. But
what year is he writing?
It's set in the 80s.
Yeah, okay. So, yeah. Like, I don't know, like, those things, those two things you've mentioned are, like...
Yeah, but he was born...
Straight after the Second World War.
But he was, like, alive in the Second World War. He remembers, like, escaping Berlin to escape the Russians. And
yeah.
So he's grown up, like, at the tail end of the Second World War, in the post-war period, and then all up to the developments of the two states in Germany as well, up to this point. So in this point in the story, he's like 40-something, mid-40s, or 40 years old. So, like, his lifetime has basically connects the end of the Second World War with the, you know, the two Berlins, basically.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is because on a, like, the stereotype, let me think about that. No, I don't think he does, because... Because I think to stereotype it, he would have to take a position that the West is better than the East. But really what he's saying is that how ultimately we're just victims of circumstance, and nothing really has any meaning. Because again, if he'd been born in the East, he would have adopted those characteristics. But only because he's born in the West, he hasn't. So he's just, I think he's outlining differences that probably are very realistic, but without a judgment value, without saying one is better than the other. If you do that, if you classify it, that's when it becomes maybe cliched or something like you mentioned, you know. But in terms of, like, to kind of expand on the idea that things become, you're a victim of circumstance, you know, one of the stories is of a guy who just keeps jumping the wall because it's there. It's like Edmund Hillary and Mount Everest. It's just there. And, like, it becomes this amazing thing because he jumps over to the East, he gets arrested, gets put back to the West. I mean, it's this huge thing because it's bureaucratic nightmare, it's a political thing, but for him, it's not really, just gets bored in his house and he wants to jump over something and the wall is just there. And in a way, it's kind of beautiful because, like, it is absurd that there's a barrier between these two parts of the city. So if he wants to go from west to east in his own city, then, you know, in most rational context, that should be possible, but it's not a rational context, so you can't do that. But he's not, like, again, being propelled by any overarching political meaning. He's just doing it because it's just something to do. There's another story of, like, these three kids who are going to the cinema. So they go from east to west to go to the cinema, see his westerns, and they come back at nighttime, for example, as well. It's just like, it's like it just becomes absorbed into the everyday life of the city and becomes something to be navigated, almost like traffic or a crowded metro or any other annoyance, pollution, you know, any other annoyance of a city. And then, like, there's kind of more extreme examples of people actively trying to dismantle the wall or things around the wall or becoming more political. And even though you kind of see maybe why they would be motivated to do that, because it's just one person acting on their own, as I mentioned earlier, it's just like this kind of anachronism. It's this thing that stands out as it doesn't have any kind of sense of place or meaning. It seems absurd. There's only one person doing it. So it's like you have this thing which is divisive and you can be against it, but then if you act on that attitude of being against it, then it's kind of weird because nobody else is doing it and all these kind of things. It's just like, where is the meaning in living in a city when you have this barrier? Because if you try and go over it, maybe it's for nondescript reasons, or even you try to challenge it, it's not kind of connected to some kind of wider, deeper thing. So it becomes weird. It's, I mean, it's weird. It's a strange thing. I don't know if that makes sense.
No, that makes sense.
Yeah.
I think we kind of tend to assume that it's like two separate cities. So I think like very often like people forget that the people that were living on either side would have any concept of Berlin as a city, you know, as a whole. So the sort of things that you're saying, that it's kind of like barriers that you have to negotiate, then I think a lot of people that are not from there probably take it for granted that they were studied lives and they studied lives and they didn't like have the concept of like the city being the whole thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, they kind of like, I don't know, they didn't identify with each other. And of course, like that's not as clear cut because there were a lot of people that were left kind of like half families and so on.
Yeah.
So of course those people, and also it's not that long a time span to,
yeah,
for people to forget what was on the other side of the wall and yeah, so on. So I think those are like key aspects for,
yeah. Well, even in the book he's allowed to go from west to east to visit the people, and there's interesting things that, yeah, in the west the bars stay open later, there's better music, there's better beer, and in the east it's just obviously because it's not capitalist, you don't have a choice basically, you know, from who you vote for to what you drink.
I think like better, yeah, beers, I think that surprises me because better beer is subjective, isn't it? I mean, I know he's German, like
a wider selection of beers. At least you have options. But that's the thing. You can go to a good bar or a bad bar, but if it's a bad, yeah, bar, you can go to a good bar. But if you're in East Berlin, it's like, well, there's nowhere you can really go and there's not much you can really drink. You know what I mean?
Okay.
Maybe that's subjective as well. But the last thing I can say about the book before we go to part three is like there's also a very interesting chapter where he talks about his friend Pomerer. I'll just check the back of the book. That's correct. Yes, it is. Yes. So he's also
kind of,
just did, yeah. So yeah, it's like he's also a writer, and he's also interesting because he lives in the East, and you know, I won't go into too much detail, but basically, he's part of a band of writers who try and outwit the regime, and there's a suspicion of writers who are state sanctioned because like they've betrayed everybody, but also if they but also the other side of the thing is like if one writer does something so extreme that they're censored by the government or exiled by the government, it's also seen this or unfavorably because it's like for them it's like a balancing act between like being rebellious but not too much, otherwise you kind of like upset the balance, or but you also can't conform too much because then you're just selling out, and the whole politics of kind of being intellectual in a regime like that. He also explores in one scene where he goes drinking with them in the countryside, and there's a very interesting line where he's like, his friend Pomerer tells him, oh, you should see this place in the sunshine, and because it was like a grey day, and one of the slogans was, here it's always October. And you know, for like in a communist sense, like that's a beautiful thing, but for the writer from the west, he's like, oh, it's just depressing. So it's kind of like he explores that, you know, and tells other stories of other people who went from west to east for kind of, again, personal reasons, rather than anything kind of like really significant or substantial. But it's written in a very simple style by a guy who was a journalist in his day job, and very easy to read. But yeah, I think it's just a fascinating account of a very particular moment in time, and I'd highly recommend it.
Well, very nice, and it's called The Wall Jumper.
Exactly.
It's got that, and I think like you originally picked it up because you like the cover.
Yeah, I literally.
But it looked like it pays off.
Yeah, I literally judged the book by its cover there, but yeah.
Okay, so it's originally written in German, translated into English.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay. Well, I'll have to read and give you my opinion.
Fantastic. Well, just so you know, I read it in 4 days, so that's the time you have to beat.
Okay. Fair enough.
We'll take it from there. So I think that is time to call it. I think we've hit the Berlin Wall of our part two.
Okay.
We have to turn back.
So back to 91.
Back to 2019. And part three.
Nah.
And a musical interlude. Thank you. Welcome to part 3 of the show. So Mary, do your thing.
I very nearly said something I shouldn't have said. No, for the podcast, you can listen on any platform that you want. We're pretty much on all the main platforms, so Spotify, iTunes.
Yeah, because we haven't made a cent from Radio Public. We've covered this in the previous podcast. So,
yes, that's why I didn't say it anymore. Well, I mean, there's no harm if you want to listen on Radio Public.
It's a good platform.
By all means, you know. But yeah, you can find us anywhere you want. And we're on Twitter as well, at ElArpa1. We're on Facebook, ElArpa Media. Instagram, where you can see a picture Elda took to illustrate his wonderful trip he's just been talking about.
Very good. And also, our blog is irishsliceofmadrid.com.
True.
That number again, irishsliceofmadrid.com. So, well, we're back in business again. Is this the new season?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we'll put that in the podcast.
Do
platform.
Be jolly.
So, this is season 7, I think, of the podcast. So, episode 1. So, we're back into the thick of it. Thanks again for listening for the last 6 years, and we will, if you have, I don't know, or if you're just one guy from Michigan who's tuning in.
Are you talking to me? Thanks for listening for the past 6 years.
Yeah, to me, just
pleasure,
in general.
Pleasure.
So yeah, we'll be back next week and throughout the year with more stuff, and good luck.
Mm-hmm. And good night.
Bye-bye. Yeah, you're out of practice.
No.
You don't know how to say goodbye.
No.
Okay. Well... The ElArpa Podcast, the home for cultural chit-chat in and outside Madrid. People will talk.